Well, you know, it's been a long time coming. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Hi, Randy. How are you? It is great to be here. Thanks very much for making this happen. It's been many years that you and I have been in touch, so it's great to have this opportunity.
Were there any specific musicians that influenced your style of singing?
I would have to say that it really is musicians, not vocalists, that have influenced the way I do what I do and how I do it, and how I've learned and changed over the years. Definitely Charlie Christian, great guitarist from long ago. Miles Davis, definitely. We've all been influenced by him so dramatically. There are so many different ways that he's touched us because his musical journey was so varied and so remarkable. Chucho Valdez, definitely. Stan Getz, another great saxophone player. Paul Desmond, I think, has to be in there. Chick Corea, without a doubt. Keith Jarrett. And did I say Charlie Hayden? I'll definitely have to put Charlie Hayden in there. Big Spider Beck, again, from days gone by. And very, very much my working band and the folks that I perform with, Barry Sames, Aaron Graves, Lee Smith, who is Christian McBride's father, Marlon Simon, fabulous Venezuelan drummer, percussionist, Chris Farr, young tenor sax player, Terrell Stafford, amazing trumpet player.
Was there anything specific about their playing that you really enjoyed?
Well, I've just given you a very long list of folks who have influenced me, definitely. And, you know, you're always hearing things subliminally as you go through the day or putting things on. I don't think I put things on specifically to listen and learn from for my own performances, per se. It's just all goes into that auditory mixer in there and comes out at the oddest of times, I guess. There's this great synthesis that happens as you go through your life listening and listening and listening. I mean, I'm sure that I've learned a lot of things from all of the classical music that I listen to as well, which is phenomenal in its breadth and scope. So I guess I've already touched on Miles and the incredible variety and vibrance and intensity that he brought to all of his playing, and definitely something to learn from Keith Jarrett, his brilliance as well, and his heart and soul. I suppose that would be the common theme through all of these people, is that they put so much of themselves, so much of their hearts into every note that they play, that's what comes through. I don't think it's so much as, I mean, we could get very technical and talk about chord progressions and things like that, but I think it's really just an overarching feel, especially, you know, Paul Desmond's lines, his melodic lines on the saxophone are just so haunting and so magical. Charlie Hayden, what he does on the bass is just, you know, just flips me out. And it's more that sense of what they do and how they do it that you incorporate. So,
oftentimes musicians will go back in time and listen to older recordings that they might pick up, maybe a technique or some kind of lesson that they might incorporate into what they're doing now. Do you tend to tread along those lines, Barbara?
Always listening, like I said, always, always listening. There's just so much fabulous music that's being recorded all the time. There's so much that has been recorded, so much that I've heard, so much that I haven't heard. And not just in jazz. I mean, the Dave Matthews Band, there's some really kicking stuff that Dave Matthews and a lot of the pop bands are coming out with today, and it's just great to keep on listening, to keep your ears fresh. I know that there have been things that influenced me very directly, of course. Grant Green, his song Idle Moments, which is such a haunting and beautiful piece of instrumental music, That definitely gave me an idea immediately of lyrics that I was compelled to write, and that's on my latest CD. There's an Arturo Sandoval arrangement of Joy Spring that I just came across in the past year, and I would love to do a musical version of his arrangement of that, and of course not the exact Arturo Sandoval arrangement, because that's his, but take it and incorporate it into my style. So it happens, it certainly happens, and we're influenced, as I say, by so many things on so many different levels. I don't think I actually consciously sit down. I stumble upon them, which is, I think, a nice way to go about it. You know, they're like little found treasures and gems.
When it comes to jazz and creating, challenges always crop up, and I think that's what makes it so exciting, not only listening, but performing and being part of the whole jazz experience.
Always looking for things that keeps us all fresh and keeps us on the edge and keeps us exploring and finding ourselves and finding our voice. Definitely the Chick Corea project that I took on for Dakiniland was an amazing challenge. Chick's music is so remarkable, and to listen to, there's such a facility that he has with his playing that it makes you think, oh, well, you know, I know this is this or that technically, but that just sounds so easy. And then you take it apart and try and sing it, and then you realize, whoa, this is a challenge, and there's a reason why not a lot of folks have sung a lot of his repertoire since Flora Purim did it so brilliantly in the 70s. So, yeah, I think we're always doing that, always doing that.
Are there any musicians who are no longer with us who you would have loved to have performed with?
Recently, a wonderful tenor saxophone player who I had the great fortune to meet over the telephone and have a relationship with over the phone passed away, Teddy Edwards, who recorded the first bop tenor sax solo back in the 40s, and I wish that I had been able to record with him, perform with him, his music that he has written, and one of his songs that I perform live, Don't Touch Me, is such a beautiful song, and I spoke to him about 2 weeks before he passed away, of course not knowing that he was going to be gone so quickly, and he was a very, very special man. Jaco Pastorius, who was intensely brilliant bassist in the 70s, and his flame burned out so quickly. But I remember his first album that came out, and just listening to that was, I would have loved to have known him and performed, played with him. And Joe Williams on the vocal side, Joe Williams. That would have been a kick.
Many years ago, Barbara, I watched a variety show. I think it was one of the top variety shows at the time. It was called The Mike Douglas Show, and I believe it was based out of Philadelphia. Now, I understand that you worked there for a while. What was it like?
Working on The Douglas Show was such a learning experience. I learned an immense amount about the entertainment business, of course, and about television production, and then obviously from the folks who came on the show, the musicians were just, you know, Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd was on the show, and Benny Goodman and Ella Fitzgerald, and Benny Goodman, I already said Benny Goodman, let's see, Tony Bennett, so many to listen to and to watch and to see how they did what they did, and I learned a lot. I think the relationships that I've kept up, though, for the people who work behind the scenes, and they have all gone on to such amazingly interesting careers in the creative world that have influenced a host of people across the country in terms of what they've done in film and television, and we've all stayed in touch, which has been great, that constant source of creativity. You know, it's great.
If you only had to make a recording with one musician, I know this is tough, who would it be?
These are very unfair questions when you say just one musician that I have yet to record with or that I'd want to record with who is still living. I mean, it's, you know, very, very tough. But I would have to say Charlie Hayden would be the one. His last several CDs with his, you know, his Quartet West have just been my kind of music, I guess. Well, that's why he records it as music, so I don't have to talk about it. You can go out and listen to the CDs, and you'll know what I'm talking about. But yes, Charlie, I would love to. In fact, I actually sat next to him once on a plane in the 70s when I was touring, and on the same plane touring with rock and roll bands and doing some tech work, as I say. Blue Oyster Cult was on the airplane, and there was Charlie Hayden. He and I sat together, and little did I know that I should have gotten his phone number then to keep for 30 years later.
Many musicians at some point in their life fantasize about forming dream bands. Some of them are lucky enough to have a dream band that is backing them up or that they're working with. Have you ever thought of forming a dream band? And if you did, who would it consist of?
You can't possibly expect me to answer this question off the top of my head. Wow, you're getting tougher instead of easier. You know, they're just, the list would just be so very, very long. But right up front would be the musicians that I play with now. I have a dream band, who I mentioned earlier, Lee Smith on bass, Aaron Graves and Barry Sames alternating on piano, John Swanna, who is a trumpet player out of Philly, who is remarkable. Terrell Stafford, another trumpet player. John Blake, the jazz violinist. Marlon Simon on drums and percussion. Dan Monahan, my drummer as well. You know, these are really remarkable, remarkable musicians. And it's a dream to play with them every time we perform. And I would have to just probably include those folks that I mentioned in our first question, definitely.
You've been afflicted with a terrible, devastating illness known as Lyme's disease. Now, how has this affected your performing?
The Lyme disease definitely had a huge effect, because it did quite literally just about take me out permanently. Had it for a long time before got diagnosed. Had it for a long time before there was a symptom. And naturally, like so many other Lyme disease patients, it was very atypical, mimicked a lot of other illnesses, had a lot of misdiagnoses, and was on a pretty serious downward spiral. I was in the midst of finishing my second CD, Ask Me Now, and had to stop recording because at a certain point I could no longer move. I could no longer speak, didn't have enough strength really to breathe, so each breath was a full-time job, just to breathe in and breathe out. And then the nerve damage that I've been left with, you know, pretty painful. But I have to say that the one time that I do not have pain is when I am performing, and that is I'm such a blessing, because otherwise I have it pretty much all the time from what I'm left with. But I'm very, very fortunate to have come back as far as I have from the edge of the precipice. Coming back was difficult indeed because I had a intravenous in my arm, and I remember the first couple of gigs I did, I still had it in my arm. I literally was kind of rolled out of bed, went to the performance because I just had to get back, was taken back right away, and passed out. And it was exhausting. And I still find that I cannot bounce back after a performance. It takes me about a day or two to recover completely. Just the fatigue and things like that. But the fact that I can perform again and I can't play the piano anymore because of the nerve damage or play the violin, but I write and, you know, do lots of other things, so I'm really very, very lucky.
Miles Davis was an incredibly gifted musician, but one of the things that I love the most about him was that he was able to surround himself with younger musicians, and I think that this really benefited in the music that was produced. It was fresh, it was invigorating, and it was exciting. What are your thoughts on Miles Davis bringing in younger people into the band?
That's a wonderful question, and I agree so much with Miles Davis. In fact, I've been fortunate to have two young men who I met when they were at the Temple School of Music for Jazz in Philadelphia on a scholarship program that I am on the board of. And I met them at some of the functions there, and while they were going through their schooling and after they graduated, this past December, I hired them both to do two nights with me at a wonderful club here in Philadelphia, Zanzibar Blue, and it was so wonderful to have seen them from when they started to develop, and they're constantly developing and growing and changing and learning and adding their musical perspectives and ideas, to have that fresh outlook from folks who are that young and coming up through the tradition of jazz. And I think everybody else, though, in the band is the same. We actually talk about it, about how to stay fresh, how to stay not, you know, you can get locked into some things that are comfortable, but there are a lot of musicians who do that because of the nature of how they're playing and where they're playing. As we all know, you can take a vow of poverty to be a jazz musician, so sometimes your gigs may not be the most challenging or allow you even to go out there. But I think anybody who stays in the jazz field definitely wants to keep pushing it and moving it around no matter how old they are. So that just goes with the territory. In fact, we were at a gig on this past Sunday night up in the around the New Hope area of Pennsylvania, and did a couple of tunes. I just turned around and said, you know, let's do it this way. We've never done it this way. Let's just try it right now. And those are the nice things to try and do when you have that kind of relationship and security with your band, that you all know you can go somewhere, and even if you make a mistake, you know that you learn a lot more from that mistake than playing it safe. And everybody is there to support you and bring you back in. And, you know, it takes you somewhere else every time you try it. So it's an important thing to have that environment around you when you perform and when you record as well.
When you were growing up, did music come naturally to you?
When we were growing up, we had a pretty peripatetic lifestyle. My dad was a engineer for an international corporation. There were five kids. We moved every 2 years or so around the country, Canada, overseas. And I think just to keep us in line, one of the techniques my folks used was to sing with us and to us. And we sang. I remember singing all of the standards from, you know, my parents' generation that are jazz standards now. We just sang all the time. And because we lived in a lot of different countries, and my mother was a language, foreign language teacher, your ear develops to hear so many different sounds. And I think that definitely has been helpful in my music, to have an ear that is very open and receptive to lots of different sounds. You know, Portuguese and Italian and French, Chinese, Vietnamese, they're very musical languages, just to speak them. So because I had, I think, that environmental influence, even though we didn't have any formal music lessons when we were kids, definitely made things easier for me.
What was it that made you decide that you wanted to sing?
The defining moment, actually, this is really a true story, as hokey as it sounds. But my mom and I used to watch. Of course, I don't remember her being there, but I'm sure she had to be there because I was 5 years old. And where we were living at the time, and TV was a recent development. Don't want to give away too much there in the years department, but this particular station didn't have a lot of programming, and it played movies from the 30s and the 40s, and all the musicals, just these great, great, great musicals, the Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, the Busby Berkeley films, 42nd Street, just fabulous films. And even the ones that weren't musicals, inevitably there would be a nightclub scene, and there would be a singer in front of a great jazz orchestra in the long gown at this classic microphone singing with a spotlight on her. And that's when I realized I want to do that when I grow up. Now, I certainly didn't get there right away. I got there once and took a lot of detours, but that's when I wanted to sing, and that's when I realized that's what it would be at some point.
What did you listen to when you were growing up?
I think, again, because we moved around so much, we listened to a lot of different things because we were in so many different parts of the country, and radio in the 50s and 60s was very different than it is today, especially in the 50s. 60s, there was still more of a selection. Now we've gotten kind of homogenized on the radio, which is a shame, but definitely living overseas, when you are listening to AFRS radio, you get a certain kind of programming every hour, and it changes all the time, so we were exposed to a lot of different kinds of music. Classical music was definitely important. The pop music of the day, R&B, the real R&B in the 50s, and jazz. Jazz became something that I was really drawn to. I was living overseas when the Beatles exploded, so they really didn't have the same effect on me that they had on folks in America. I was living in Southeast Asia, which made it even more different. But I did learn to appreciate them when I got back to the States. Probably one of my favorites, even I remember in the early 60s, was John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, which is a British blues band, but he was phenomenal. I remember really playing that poor album over and over and over and over again.
Did your parents come from a musical background?
I think because it was such a full-time job to keep five kids and house and home and all that good stuff while you were traveling around. The singing was the one thing. I know my parents loved music, appreciated it immensely. I don't know if either of them ever played an instrument. You know, that's funny. I never thought about that. But they never did, certainly, when they were raising us. And I didn't find out until much later, shortly before my father passed away, that there was any music in the family at all. I did find out from him that great-grandfathers in Sweden, where my grandparents were from, but the great-grandfathers on both sides, one was a concert violinist and the other was a professor of music and had the King of Sweden as one of his students. So there's music back there.
I always have a tough time asking this question, Barbara, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If you were stranded on a desert island, what 10 recordings would you take? Now, I want you to limit them to only 10 recordings. I know this. I've asked so many musicians this, and they go off on tangents where they list probably 20 or 30 recordings. It's very hard. I know it's a very tough question, but what 10 recordings would you take if you were stranded on a desert island?
I refuse to answer this one.
Brandy,
what 10 recordings would I take and why? You know, I could not give you a list of 10. I could only say that it would have to be a diverse musical selection. I don't think it would be a jazz-heavy repertoire. I think definitely there would be probably more classical music in there, because if I'm stranded and I'm going to be there, there's a reason classical music has survived hundreds and hundreds of years. You just never get tired of listening to it. So I know there'd be some Mozart. There would be the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. I can tell you that. That's one, the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. There'd be some Beethoven. There'd be a Chopin, Debussy, Charlie Hayden, the Quartet West. And you know what? There's one tune that Pat Metheny wrote, Letters from Home. I don't think I'd take the whole CD, but I would definitely take that that song. Maybe Under the Missouri Sky. Now I'm starting to give you specific albums, and I said I wouldn't do that. So let's go on to the next question.
Of the recordings that you've made so far, do you have a favorite that you prefer over the other ones? If I'm making any sense here, Barbara?
That's like asking, who is your favorite child? You know, I've been fortunate to have done four CDs. The last one is definitely very close to my heart because it is mainly original material, things that I have written with Barry Sames. So that's, and it came at a very cathartic time right after September 11th and a lot of other things that were going on personally in my life. Dakini Land is incredibly important to me because of the connection and the relationship with Chick Corea and the huge amount that I learned, and the music is so phenomenal. His music is so phenomenal. Ask Me Now was very important because it was during the course of my illness and also when my mother passed away. So that has a very special, it's a very quieter kind of a thing. And the first one was the first, so that's special. So I don't think I answered your question.
How difficult was it acquiring Dave Weckl's services when you made your very first recording?
Actually, it wasn't so challenging at all. Again, I was so fortunate. I had been working with Michael Sembello in the work that I do for my day job, which is as a music producer and producing music for Richard Simmons, exercise and weight loss fellow, who is a dear friend. And when I was working with Michael, I had wanted to do my first CD, and Michael just called folks up, and he has had such a great relationship with these people that they said, okay, fine, we'll come on over. And we did that live in one day. Dave and Randy and Chuck Berghofer, who came in from Las Vegas. He's Frank Sinatra's bass player. And we started and just did them all in pretty much one or two takes, and that was it. I met them, and we said, hello, how do you do? Let's get going. That was interesting. It's a lot of fun.
I think some of the greatest musicians in jazz never forgot what it was like to be a child. And I'm thinking of Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, and Duke Ellington. They always had that childlike aura about them, always discovering, always wondering, and always creating, like a child creates. Barbara, do you have any thoughts on this and the importance of it in creating music?
I think that's a good theory. That's a very good theory. I think it's something that we all should try very hard to stay in touch with, that that immense sense of wonder as we walk around the world and look at things in our universe, to constantly look through the eyes of a child. And sadly, we get very jaded and take things for granted as the days go by, and kind of, you know, start taking on layers and layers and layers, like the onion, you know, growing. And it would be nice if we could all get to a point where we see, oh my gosh, you know, we got to start peeling these layers away and get back to that core. Because the world is a magical and wonderful place. And yes, it is a very scary and horrific place, especially right now. But if we could keep that sense of wonder and awe and appreciation for the beauty that is there, maybe we wouldn't muck it up so much. Maybe.
The notion of formulating ideas from a point of view of a non-rigid construction is actually quite appealing when you think about it, dealing with jazz, as opposed to rigid ideas which constrain the creativity of the artist. I'm sure that you have some comments on this.
Yeah, I think actually that's pretty a good survival technique. I think it is ideal for my life. I mean, I can only say for me, especially growing up the way I grew up. If we were very rigid and had to be in that box all the time, I don't think any of us would have survived in moving into so many different cultural situations, and that we would have lost so much in our appreciation and not learned all the things that we've learned to be able to use later on in life in all sorts of different ways. You never know when it's going to pop up, all those things that come in when you're growing up, and then being able to use that ability to, as you say, floating, keeping things fluid, keeping things liquid, keeping things malleable. That's how you can stay open to other people's ideas, and you're not challenged in terms of or being threatened, because everybody is working together for the greater good of whatever it is that you're working on. If you're collaborating with somebody, not only in a musical sense, but just in your personal life as well, that, you know, to keep your ears open and truly listen and not hold your own ideas or concepts so firmly. Yes, you know, you do have a core belief structure, and we hope that it's all those wonderful things like loving kindness and compassion and tolerance. But there are so many different ways to express those ideas, be it in different religious practices, spiritual practices, musically, you know, all sorts of different ways to achieve the same end in that positive way. And so you really need to, yeah, stay as open as you possibly can, or else you'll miss a lot.
Do you prefer performing or writing?
Very different things. I really enjoy performing because of the ability to be on stage with my fellow musicians and to learn so much and have such joy in that exchange of ideas. And also to have the ability, if we're doing a good job, reaching out and communicating with an audience and touching them in a positive, we hope, in a very positive way. And that relationship that develops over the course of an evening is so special and so privileged. So I really enjoy that. When I start to write, you get into a zone. I mean, something just kind of clicks, and I suppose, like many other creative people talk about the same thing. The rest of the world kind of disappears, and you're there, and it's intensely satisfying in a more intimate way. So you're not having that relationship with others, and I think you need them both as a balance, you know, to your life. So I really enjoy them both.
Are you one of the fortunate ones who can write quickly, where ideas come to you and you're able to create a composition in a relatively short amount of time?
You know, I have been fortunate that most of the things that I've written have come pretty quickly. I mean, once the initial idea is there, I mean, some of them have come literally. I'm driving down the road and I have to pull off to the side because it's just there. It comes as a stream of consciousness. There are other times where I've had ideas for thoughts will come and I jot them down in my book that I carry with me, and some more thoughts will come later, and then, you know, they will gel into something. I have found that if I try and sit down and really force something, it's not as true as I want it to be. But I have done it, and I do that to try and discipline myself. And then usually what happens, though, I'll go back to that and see where it's been forced, and it will open a door or turn on a light and will trip the, you know, the switch to what it should be. So it all, I guess, has its place, but I would say that more often than not, when things start to come, they come relatively quickly. I don't labor over things because I do want to keep it fresh and pure and really from my heart and not from my cortex.
Is there a particular setting that you prefer when you're performing?
You know, I really love playing with having a couple horns up there and percussion. So like a quintet or a sextet is terrific. although I've been fortunate to be with a 60-piece ensemble, and that was amazing. But I guess I'm most comfortable with that quintet, sextet. However, I have had a performance with just piano and voice recently, and that is so remarkable and so challenging because your vulnerability is really at its utmost. There's no one else to hide behind, just piano and voice. So that was a wonderful experience. I'd like to do more of that. I really would.
Over the years, there have been many comments from American musicians regarding the level of respect that they receive overseas as compared to America. For example, in Europe and Japan, they tend to have more of an insight into what the musician is about. They view the musician as an artist rather than just a commodity. I was wondering what your thoughts are on this.
Well, I would have to agree. I think I've not performed in Japan. I have traveled there, but I have performed in Europe, and it is true that there is an incredibly high level of respect and appreciation for the arts, not just for music, but for painting, for writers, for every aspect of the artistic world. I think they have a much longer, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years tradition of appreciating and educating folks in their cultures about the arts and the importance of them, and they were integrated into their societies. I mean, the court musicians, you know, so many, you know, things were commissioned all the time, music, painting, sculpture, and by the patrons of the different countries. And we just don't have that in the States, and we don't teach it to our children. And sadly, the first things to go in music programs, I mean, in school programs, are the music programs, are the art programs. We are not instilling that appreciation in our kids, so we shouldn't be surprised if they don't know how to behave when they are out at a club, an audience, you know, they don't know that they should be quiet and listening. They just haven't learned that. We just don't do that, and it's very sad. I find it very, very sad, and we become very narrow in our appreciation of different forms of art as well, I think. But in Europe, I'll tell you, I've just been so blessed, because you go over there and you get recharged, because you see that they really have such great anticipation for whatever you're going to do, and their appreciation is immense. People run up with flowers after every performance. It's just something that they know to do. You can hear a pin drop as soon as the musicians begin, no matter what the setting is, be it a club or a concert. So I hope we can turn that around here in America.
There's an interesting story around your third release, Dakini Land.
Dakini Land came about by one song in particular, Crystal Silence, song of Chukuria's that I was trying to find lyrics to, and looked and looked and looked and looked, and of course, you know, I just can't see the forest for the trees. As it turned out later on, I had a real book that had lyrics in it, and I never bothered to look at the real book, but I called up lots of folks and looked on the internet and just couldn't find any lyrics, and a friend of mine who's a program director at a radio station said, well, I don't know if there are any, but Chick is coming in tonight for an interview. Why don't you come down and meet him and you can ask him yourself? And what a gift that was. I went down and Chick was gracious enough to meet me, and I asked him, and he said, yep, sure are, Neville Potter, my good friend and lyricist, and I'll send them to you, and I have some other songs that, you know, I've done that have lyrics, and I'll send those, and away we went from there. And he is an amazing, amazing person. His kindness has been, and his generosity has been phenomenal over the last couple of years that we've known each other. And he is so very busy that our communication is usually via the email. But I've seen him up in New York at the Blue Note when he did his birthday celebration there, which was amazing, 3 weeks there. And then had some dinner with him down here when he was down here performing a couple years ago, and we just sit and talk about the music and about life, and He's a remarkable person in every aspect, and was kind enough to write lyrics for Armando's Rumba, which is one of my favorite songs of his. He wrote that for his father, and that's on the new CD. And also to allow me to premiere a song that was never recorded, that he wrote with Neville Potter, and Neville wrote the lyrics for his wife, and that's on the new CD. And Neville said he got a kick out of it because it certainly wasn't the way they had heard it in their minds. But he was very gracious in saying that that's the way it should sound. So it's been wonderful.
Now, if I were to pick one song off of Dakini Land, it would have to be Some Time Ago. That is my favorite, I think my favorite version of this Korea classic. I've heard Flora Purim's version. It's a very interesting version, but yours takes a different route.
Some Time Ago. Oh, what a beautiful song. That comes actually out of the middle of one of Chick's songs called La Fiesta. And there's this magnificent long piece, and in the middle of it, you've got this beautiful tiny little gem, Some Time Ago. And just let John Blake run with that is pretty much what we did, because he really set it up for us. He and Barry Sames, the piano player, that whole intro really set things up and gave it, as you said, floating before. That was the one thing that Marlon Simon, who was the percussionist and drummer on that, after we got finished with it, he said, you know, B, you know, you floated over the top. You know, and it really, the music lent itself to just floating melodically over what was happening. Thank you. It's a favorite of mine as well.
I'm going to throw some names your way, and I want you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind. Let's get started. Duke Ellington.
Fabulous. And class.
How about vocalist Chris Connor?
Generous. And cool and kind. I went to see her at Zanzibar Blue when she was here in Philadelphia several years ago. Got very bold and went backstage to talk to her, and she was just great. And she and I sat and talked for a minute, and she said, you know, just do what you do. That's what Stan Kenton told her. Don't worry about what everybody else is doing. You know, the whole trend with female vocalists scatting and feeling that they have forced to scat. If they don't, they're not a true jazz performer or jazz vocalist. And of course, Chris does not. She sings the song. And she said, just do what's in your heart and do what you do. And she was wonderful.
How about pianist Bill Evans?
Genius. Genius. Absolute genius.
And vocalist Peggy Lee.
Intelligent, very smart lady, with fire.
One of the greatest all-round vocalists ever, the great Sarah Vaughan.
Remarkable, just remarkable. Her spirit in every note that came out of her mouth, was so deep.
Newcomer Nora Jones.
New kid on the block. Love the CD. Sorry that she got hit with so much backlash, but I don't think that was her doing it all. Again, the business tries to label you, and the more they try and label you, the more people are going to take umbrage with the label that they give you. She's a good singer. And like Ellington said, there's good music and bad music, and she makes some good music.
When you looked at popular music back in the 40s, 50s, and even 60s, it was actually quite different than the popular music of today in many respects, from a business standpoint, and even the way that recordings are made. The whole thing is just so different. What is your view on this?
Well, I do think the halcyon days were in the, you know, the 50s into the 60s, amaze me going back and listening to a lot of that work. That, of course, the business of music was so very different in the 60s and into the 70s. There were A&R departments that were interested in developing artists and not worrying about a one-hit wonder, and that's what we've got these days. We have one-hit wonders. Back then, you could, an entire Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album, or Buffalo Springfield, every single track was brilliant. Every single one in the pop world. And now, no. But I don't think that's so much a function of the talent that's out there. I think the talent is being driven by the business, sadly. And the radio stations are part of this horrible process as well, because of the conglomerates that are taking them over and homogenizing everything. And they want to make money, and they know that this kind of a song makes money, so let's have more of that kind of a song. And if you want to, you know, not be a starving artist, you know, that kind of is a big carrot at the end of that stick. Certainly is not across the board, because there are those gems out there that are still doing their music, still being creative, going against the grain, but it is a tough, tough, tough battle that's going on. And the listener is the one who loses out, of course, because they don't have that incredible variety of music to listen to.
There are many underrated musicians in the world of jazz. And one of them that comes to mind is violinist John Blake.
John Blake is a beautiful musician and a beautiful person. We just did a Philadelphia Jazz All-Star concert a couple of weeks ago to benefit music programs in a school system out here and down here, wherever we are. And John was there and played some of his original music and then joined me on The Reason Why, which is an original song of mine that's on Bikiniland that Barry Sames and I wrote. And when we were rehearsing, I said, John, I want you to really, you know, play on this one, because you did such a beautiful solo on it when you were on the CD. And he said, that was 2 years ago. I'm not going to remember that. As soon as we started to play it, he looks up at me and his eyes just light up. He said, I remember this. And he killed it. It was just great. He's a wonderful, wonderful person and musician.
Let's talk a little bit about your pianist, Barry Sames. How did the two of you meet?
Barry was a guy who subbed on a gig. Piano player couldn't show up. I had to get a sub. Had never met him. He was recommended. And serendipity. We are both circular thinkers, I guess, and can finish each other's sentences, and sometimes we don't even have to finish our sentences, and we know what we're talking about and or what we're feeling, and it's just been a very, very, very nice symbiotic relationship. Right now he's out in Los Angeles taking some courses in film scoring. He is an incredibly talented musician in so many different genres, and you're going to hear a lot more about Barry Sames.
Do you remember the first concert that you ever attended?
The first concert I attended was James Brown and his Band of Renown when I got back from Southeast Asia.
Do you remember what the best concert was that you ever attended?
The best concert I ever saw. You know, you stumped me on that one, Randy. I don't think... You know, there was an amazing concert performance, Chucho Valdez, three years ago at the Blue Note, when I think one of his first appearances here in the States, possibly. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but that took me out. His intensity and his everything just really, really was amazing. But I know that there are others, but you stumped me.
Do you spend a lot of time training your voice? Do you have any vocal coaches?
You know, I don't per se. I probably should. I think when I have a performance coming up, I do try to get in some rehearsals with my piano player. I do think about it quite a bit. It's interesting. I probably think about it in my head more than I vocalize it. I should probably warm up before a gig more than I do. I should do a lot of things more than what I do. When I do remember to warm up, I know that it's definitely a more relaxing performance. It's a lot of, there's just a lot of muscle stretching because you hold your face so tightly you don't realize it as you go through the day with all the talking that you do and the expressions that you make. So anything to loosen those muscles up is a good thing. I find myself making funny faces as I'm driving to the concert.
What would you have done instead if you never pursued a career in jazz?
I probably would have been a teacher. I would have been teaching in some form, some way, teaching kids, working with children, either in strictly an academic way or maybe a more philosophical way. Right now I'm doing some work with conflict resolution, gun violence prevention, especially working with kids in this aspect, which I think is so very vital, lessons that aren't being learned anymore.
Do your children have the musical bug the way that you do?
Both of my children are very much into music. As I said, I did teach them both the violin, and we had a very big music theory and music appreciation program at home, listening to the classics. I have seen them both when they were young going to a concert, and there'd be a piece that they knew how to play on the violin, and they'd be listening to the piece and not knowing that they were doing the fingering, you know, air violin while the song was being performed. So they both still play the violin. My son is 24, and they both love music and are excellent musicians. Yeah.
Do you spend any time teaching or holding clinics?
I have not really done much teaching of music per se, other than teaching both of my kids, which was a full-time job, as I say, and teaching music and teaching violin to them. Certainly is something that I don't rule out for the future.
What's up for Barbara Montgomery in the near future?
You know, I have been trying to not record. My last CD, Little Sunflower, was not an anticipated recording, and since I do produce these myself, there is a certain financial aspect to them that really should be planned, and I did not plan that one, and I realized that I should just take a break. But, some things are creeping up in my mind, and some ideas are starting to percolate, and when that happens, I know it's not long before I'll want to start putting some of these ideas down. I'm hoping I can hold off until at least the end of 2003. I have been doing some, wrote some lyrics for Freddie Hubbard after I did the lyrics for Little Sunflower, for his tune, Little Sunflower. And I got to sing with him up at the Iridium in New York, which was really terrific, and he asked me to write lyrics for some other music of his, so I'm pursuing that. And that might be something I want to check into a little bit more. There's some ideas out there.
I'd like you to discuss the importance of the artist in society.
The importance of artists in society, I think, is crucial to our success, our survival, and our ability to be civilized. I think the definition of a civilized country is one that has a great appreciation and participation in the arts in every form.
Do you remember your first live gig as a professional?
It was in a really kind of a crummy little bar. And I don't think the bar is there anymore, so I apologize for using the word a crummy little bar. But maybe, I mean, it was a great bar. It was a wonderful bar, and a lot of great bars are crummy little bars. And, that was the first one. It was a very, very long time ago. But it was great.
I'd like to feature something from one of your recordings, Barbara. What would you like to hear?
That's a tough one, too. I suppose something from the new CD would be nice. Something that we wrote would be nice. Web of Glass, I think, is a really beautiful, beautiful song. I really do love that one. Or Idle Moments, which I really love. And also, uh-oh, here I go. You know, which one of your children is your favorite? An Illusion. Take your pick, Randy.
What are you listening to these days?
I have to say my listening is pretty, across the board, pretty Catholic. I want to try and listen to everything because there's so much to learn from all aspects. Having a 15-year-old daughter helps because I'm listening to all of the, and she has pretty obscure tastes. She's not a mainstream pop fan, so listening to some pretty out there folks who are doing interesting stuff of the younger set. A lot of jazz, of course, a lot of the older things, a lot of new things. Classical is very important to me to continue listening to. I don't know if you want me to mention anybody specific, so I won't.
When it comes to composing music, are there any musicians out there that have been an influence on you?
I don't think I could name a specific influence because it is such a personal voice. It's a personal, intimate expression. So that I really don't think of anyone else when I am writing. It definitely comes from someplace very deep within.
Do you have any funny musical stories that you'd like to share with us today?
Funny things happen all the time when you're in a live performance. It's just constant things that pop up. But I would say the most interesting and wonderful musical story did not happen to me. It did happen when I was on the Mike Douglas show, and I was working backstage. Benny Goodman was on the show that day, and as would happen, there was a chimpanzee on the show as a guest that day. And when I opened up the double doors to the soundstage and closed them up again in between parts of the show, Benny was out in the scene shop area on a riser warming up, and he was on a stool, and he was playing absolutely beautiful, beautiful music, warming up, and sitting on the same riser on a slightly lower stool was this chimpanzee, and nobody else was around, and he was sitting there, mesmerized, listening to Benny Goodman, and boy, do I wish I had a camera for that moment. It was really beautiful.
One thing that you have done is you have produced all of your recordings, and I'd like to know, how important is it for you to maintain control over what you have done so far?
The recording process, which I love being in the studio with the musicians, there's a magic that gets and an energy that is amazing when you're in there. And the only special technique, I guess, is that everybody's ego gets checked at the door, and that's all you need. And, of course, you know, the musicians that I work with, that isn't even an issue. Everybody comes in and gives selflessly of their hearts and their talent, and we work together, and it's not as though it's my music or any one person's. We are all making it happen, we're so interdependent on each other, and ideas are freely exchanged about where to go with things. Definitely would say that not a lot of rehearsal, again, to trying to keep things as fresh as possible. I mean, enough so that, you know, it settles in, but so we'll rehearse in bits and pieces. When it comes to laying it down, not very many takes, because then you can lose that freshness. I guess it is important for me to have a sense of, I don't know whether control, but I certainly want to know that I'm responsible for my music, that if it's good or bad, it's on my shoulders. And so that's why I do produce them myself, even though it's, you know, financially can be a little interesting and challenging, but you do come out with exactly what you want, and that's a nice thing.
The internet has played a major role in most musicians' lives. How has it affected you?
Well, the wonderful thing is that I can communicate so much more quickly and easily, and I find out that there are a lot more folks out there that are hearing the music and taking the time to sit down and write me, which is incredibly wonderful and generous, and I really do appreciate that immensely.
Let's go back to some of the influences in your life, Barbara. Were there any vocalists that influenced your style of singing?
You know, I think your first question, hearkening all the way back to that first question about what musicians have been an influence, I have to say that I probably am more influenced and have been more influenced and do listen primarily to instrumentalists, and would say that that is where if the influence comes from, in the phrasing of their voices through their instruments. I mean, obviously, every vocalist has been influenced by Frank Sinatra. I mean, whether you know it or not, you have been. He was the first one to really be out there. Joe Williams, if I had to, you know, of course I don't sing like Joe Williams at all, but I think, again, it's more through his heart and what he puts into it, the feeling and the emotion, Sarah Vaughan, rather than technique. I can't say that, because we're all very busy listening to so many things, and I'm sure we do assimilate all these things in some way, and we're not really aware of it, but it's all in that search of trying to find your own voice, to find your own true voice, and that's what we're all doing, and it's a lifelong path that we're on, and hopefully we'll never get to the end of it.
I'd like to thank you for dropping by today, Barbara, and spending some time with us and sharing some of your experiences over the years.
Randy, thank you immensely, and take very good care.